Good morning, good afternoon, I mean. It is afternoon, right? Somewhere it's morning. Well, you are certainly an impressive bunch. Look at you. Wow. Yes. Awesome. Well, I hope you're all okay, and that you've been having a good day of sitting so far. It's a nice thing, right, to sit in such a noble room with a whole bunch of Dharma companions. I guess it's not that easy to sit by yourself. Anybody could do it at any time, but to organize a whole bunch of people to sit together with you, that's a lot harder to manage. But it is good, isn't it, to sit with others? You can tell the difference, right? Those of you who sit by yourselves, you know that it makes a difference to sit together. And every person's sincere sitting makes every other person's sincere sitting that much stronger. So it is a blessing to have a day like this. And it reminded me that long ago, when Zen Center was just beginning, there was a piece of conventional wisdom that pretty much everyone shared, and I guess it must have been handed to us from our teachers, that you do not sit Zazen by yourself. You don't do it. It's too hard, and nobody can do it. And so we believe that, and nobody ever sat Zazen by themselves. We thought you couldn't do it, because that's what they told us. And we believe that. And everybody who wanted to sit would go to a great deal of trouble to get up early in the morning if they had to go far away, you know, to the Zendo. They would get up super early in the morning to get to the Zendo because it was unthinkable that you would sit without going to a Zendo. And we still sort of have that understanding that you can't sit Zazen alone. It is impossible to sit Zazen alone. You always have to be in the middle of a group of Buddhas supported by the whole universe. That's the only way anybody can ever sit. So I don't think in those days we would have ever imagined that a day would come like the day we're in now, when there's so many people all over the place sitting at home. And that most people, so many people, have a regular meditation practice that they do by themselves at home. And once in a while they come to Green Gulch or they go somewhere else to have the experience of sitting with others. And it's a good thing that we do that now, because lots of people live pretty far away from any Zendo that they could ever get to. And so wouldn't it be terrible if they thought, well, I can only sit in a Zendo, so I guess I can't sit at all. No, people now realize, even if they're far away, they can still sit. But even when you're sitting at home alone, you aren't. You're not sitting at home alone. You are sitting in the middle of cosmic Buddhas. You're sitting at the exact center of all of life. So I think the early understanding that we had was right. We just took it too literally. And it is an awesome honor to be able to offer an address to a room full of cosmic Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So this afternoon, I would like to talk about three very short chapters in Suzuki Roshi's new book, Becoming Yourself, a book that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. The three chapters are entitled, Don't Put Another Head on Top of Your Head, Buddha nature and the great sages are yourself. So the theme of these three chapters, which really I think is the theme of Suzuki Roshi's book and the theme of all of his teaching, which is the same as the theme of Dogen Zenji's teaching, is a very radical thought. More or less, he's saying, forget about everything extra, everything external, everything imposed on you by the outside, including, especially, yourself, which, if you have a chance to look closely enough, you will see is itself a construction that you have received from your family, from your world, and you're imposing it on yourself. All outside impositions are false, and that's fine. The only trouble is that all outside impositions are suffering. That's the problem. Because they alienate you from your real self and from all of existence, which is your real self. So for Suzuki Roshi, to study Zen is not to study something external to you, some religion or some path. To study Zen is simply to become truly human, like the title says, becoming yourself. Truly yourself, to let go of all the weight that you have loaded onto yourself. It's very heavy being you and me, right? It's a big problem. Unload all that weight and just be who you are and who you have been the whole time. That sounds good. You can say it pretty easy, you know. Suzuki Roshi says it pretty easy in this book. But it's also pretty slippery when you try to live that way. Because what does it really mean? What is he really saying? And how do we understand it? And how do we live it? Because we are all so completely external to ourselves, all that we ever understand and know and feel is understood and known and felt by that very external self. So there's no way we can understand without getting it all mixed up with that. So pretty much we can guarantee that whatever we understand is wrong. So those of you who are frustrated because you don't think you understand, you're right. You don't understand. Nobody else does either. And yet, at the same time, we hear Suzuki Roshi's words, and we do know somehow. Boy, does that ever sound like the truth? It sounds right. It sounds true. Even though somehow we don't understand, we know it's true. Which then raises the question, what are we going to do about it? Well, there's an answer to that. That's where the whole machinery of practice comes into it. What we're going to do about it is we're going to do the practice. We could have all kinds of cockeyed ideas about the practice. We could have all kinds of serious resistances to it, all kinds of reluctances. But anyway, we do it. We sit, we walk, we stand, we wear robes, we bow, we chant, we eat meals, we clean our house, we go to the toilet, we take care of our body. We could do a different set of religious things, and that would be just as well, I guess. Wouldn't really matter. But somehow we're here in this zendo. Somehow we've been brought to this pass. And this is our practice. Who knows why? The point is that we put ourselves within the stream of some kind of activity that isn't based on our self-centeredness, that isn't something that we design for ourselves, that has been handed down to us from an ancient past, and we devote ourselves to it. And eventually, we will learn how to let go, how to really appreciate our external self. Only we will understand it as it really is, and we'll know what it's for. Now I'll tell you Kathy's teaching about this, which is really good. My wife Kathy sitting over there. She has a great teaching about this. She says, and she'll let me know later if I've got it right or not. As far as I understand, she says that the external self is a tool, like a hammer or a pencil. Some of you have heard her say this probably, right? And tools are good. We need a tool. We pick it up and we use it for a purpose. And we need a tool when we need that purpose accomplished. What do we need it for? We need it so that we can interact with others and the world. But also, we know how to put it down when it gets in the way. You don't want to go through life carrying your hammer around with you wherever you go, right? That would be ridiculous, cumbersome, troublesome. We pick it up when we need it, and when we're done, we put it down. And so we can understand it and appreciate it and know what it is for. I often hear people say that they have a big problem with self-judgment. They tell me they're always second-guessing themselves. They never are completely where they are or in their lives the way they want to be. They would like to be otherwise than they are or elsewhere than where they are, unsure of themselves, and especially they're constantly criticizing themselves or putting themselves down. And I always say, how could that be? How is that possible? Who would be standing next to you, looking at you, and finding fault with you? Who is that person? Is there a second you standing next to you with a big stern look on her face, shaking her head from side to side, you know, as she makes these harsh judgments of you? If you are really here, where you are, there is no second person to judge. You have created a fake second person out of habit and conditioning, and you think she's you. She's not. There is no second person. There's just you being here, doing what you are doing. Maybe it's good what you're doing, maybe it's not so good. But anyway, the goodness or the not so goodness of it are just ideas after the fact of your actually being here and doing what you're doing. And they are very flimsy. Very flimsy, these judgments, compared to the awesome actual reality that you are here, existing as you, unrepeatable, never before seen, never will be seen again, you, in this unrepeatable, sacred moment, and you have no idea what that means. Because you are beyond meaning. You are so full of meaning. You are beyond all meaning. You are truth itself. There's no room for judgment. And that's what Suzuki Roshi means when he says, don't put another head on top of your head. Don't put the usual head on top of your head, the head you think of as yourself. Try to be more here, so thoroughly here, that there is no room for that second head. When you breathe and sit here, as we do in Zazen, as we've been doing all day, there is no room for that other head. There's just breathing, just a human body, just sound, just presence, just being. Yes, maybe a thought, a feeling comes, it goes. No extra head. So that's what we're doing every day when we sit down in Zazen. We're training every day in no head on top of our head. It is, as Suzuki Roshi says in this chapter, much easier to live our lives in a balanced and sane way when we've only got one head. And then he says, don't put a Buddha head on top of your head either. Because we could do that. People do that, right? We could try to forget our usual low-grade self and change it into a much higher grade Buddha self. We could fill our heads with all kinds of wonderful Buddhist concepts and practices and ideas and values, all of which we could impose on ourselves, and we could have a new, improved Buddha self, which we're very proud of, that is kind, aware, compassionate, unselfish, perfect in every way, and pure. It wouldn't last long. It would be another head on top of your own. One head is good. Although, somebody might say, actually, I don't think so. I think it's better to have a lot of heads. I have several. If one head is good, two would be twice as good, and three, three times as good, and four times as good. And you know what? Maybe so. I don't say not, you know. Maybe so. I can easily imagine someone who's convinced that that would be the way. And I guess that is one way a person could live. Suzuki Roshi is telling us that the truest way to be human, the best human way, the way that the Buddha recommended, is one head only. Just be who we really are. Live the gift we have been given in this lifetime in the most honest and straightforward way possible. At the end of the chapter, Suzuki Roshi writes a sentence that seems a little surprising. I think this is the last sentence in the chapter. He says, we realize our own head when we are under some limitation. And those of you who are familiar with Suzuki Roshi's words will be familiar with that. He says that all the time in different ways. Usually, when he says this, what he means is practice. We place ourselves under the limitation of practice so as to realize our own head. After all, what could be a bigger limitation than Zazen? You know, sit here in this little square of space, fold your legs up and don't move. I mean, that's even more limited than falling asleep. When you're sleeping, at least you can turn around in bed, you know. But also, I think he means that to be alive is already to be under a severe limitation. We have a body and mind subject to impermanence. Definitely our body will not work sometime. It will be injured, it will break down. Our body will go, our mind will go, or maybe our mind will go even while our body's walking around and doing all kinds of things, the mind doesn't work. And every single day we depend on food and air and water. We need gravity to hold us in place. And we need others to give us love and attention. To be alive is to be living under some limitation, not only some limitation, but total limitation. We think we're free and independent, which may seem great and also scary. But there's no freedom. Or, put it another way, freedom is understanding the way we are, the limitation we live under. If we're separate, autonomous beings, divorced from the rest of reality, then these limitations are really terrible and we resent them. But if we're just here, just who we are, then we are those very limitations. And that's why they don't limit us. Being who we are and as we are, animals on this earth together, is our deepest freedom. It's very beautiful. For Suzuki Roshi and for Dogen, Zazen is the truest expression of our absolute freedom and our utter and total limitation. The next chapter is called Buddha Nature, and Suzuki Roshi says, the purpose of practice, now that got my attention, the purpose of practice is to directly experience Buddha nature. Whatever you do, it should be the direct experience of Buddha nature. He doesn't say we should work hard in our zazen and have a big experience of Buddha nature that we will always remember for the rest of our lives. He doesn't say that. Not that that's not a good idea, but that doesn't seem to be what he's saying. He is saying that everything we do all the time should be a direct experience of Buddha nature. Maybe we could simply say, well, Buddha nature is just not putting another head on top of your head. That the first head, the true head, is Buddha nature. Just being here as we really are, who we are, is Buddha nature. So to live this way as much as possible, directly as he puts it, is the purpose of our practice. And then he says, Buddha nature is beyond good and bad. He means beyond judgment, beyond discrimination. Buddha nature, he says, is not our crabby, small, external self. It is big self, our true head. It's always there whenever we are there. And it is aware of our life because it is our life. And it always says, no matter what we do, and this is what he says in the chapter. It always says, ah, that's good, no matter what we do. Ah, that's good, there's nothing wrong with it. So Buddha nature is radical acceptance, radical goodness, radical forgiveness, and beyond forgiveness, because there's nothing to forgive. So that's why we're always, always, always forgiven, no matter what. Now, this is an important point and a little subtle, because it sounds like Suzuki Roshi is saying that, well, we can be easygoing in our living to the point of being lackadaisical or immoral or amoral, because what's the difference? It's all good, right? Like they say, it's all good, it's all good. And if everything we do is good, then what's to worry about? Just follow your impulses, wherever they may lead, it sounds like he's saying. But I don't think he means that. If you read that chapter, it's a little bit unclear what he's saying, but he brings up the example of the Japanese, famous, very famous Japanese monk poet Ryokan. Maybe you've heard of Ryokan, who lived as a simple hermit. And he says, Ryokan always accepted everything in his life. He accepted his poverty, his own incompetence and foolishness, his old age, his illnesses, all of his setbacks and troubles. He always accepted. Once a thief robbed him and jumped out the window, and he said, did you get enough? I would give you the moon if it was mine. He accepted everything. He always said about everything, it's good, there's nothing wrong with it. But, Suzuki Roshi says, when Ryokan met someone who he could see was serious about practice, he was very strict, very sharp. He wanted that person to pay attention to their life, to practice diligently, and to keep precepts, which means to do good, not bad stuff. And Ryokan himself kept precepts. He accepted everything in his own heart and the world around him, but he was always careful to do the good stuff and not to do the bad stuff. To live in accord with Buddha nature doesn't mean that we're perfect. Everybody has troubles and problems. Everybody has good impulses and bad impulses. Everybody has good conduct and conduct that maybe is not too good. We accept our own mind and our own conduct, just as we accept the mind and the conduct of others. We say, it's good, there's nothing bad. There's no righteousness and no condemnation anywhere in Buddha nature. And we know what to do and what not to do. And we always try our very best to practice kindness and non-harming. And when we fail at that, we forgive ourselves and we try again. Always try again. Suzuki Roshi's words about Buddha nature remind me of the story of creation in the Bible. As you know, the world was created in 6 days. And on the seventh day, God took a rest. But at the end of every day of created work, it says in the Bible, God saw that it was good. That good doesn't mean good, not bad. It means good, including the good and the bad. When God created the sun and the moon, or the plants and the animals, they weren't good, not bad. They were good, really good. They were reality, truth, which includes good and bad. Good and bad are really important ideas for us human beings. But for God and for Buddha nature, good and bad are both good. In the sun and moon and plants and animals, there's no good and bad. What happens just happens as it must. Everything is patiently accepted, including death. And everything goes always as it must. But in the human world, for us human beings, there is good and bad, and we are definitely committed to doing good because that's the natural way for human beings to live, to make our best effort to do good. And he ends his chapter with the old saying, you can't plant a flower on a stone, and you can't drive a needle into a rock. It means that when your Buddha nature is secure in you, when you live in touch with it, you no longer are deluded by good and bad. Your Buddha eye is wide and forgiving, and you accept everything. And you're no longer tempted to do self-centered, foolish things. So one more little bit, last chapter I want to comment on today. The great sages are you yourself. That says it all. The great sages are you yourself. And he says, who really is Buddha or Jesus or Moses or Muhammad or Lao Tzu? If these sages live forever, it's because generation after generation until time ends, beings express their truth. Don't put a head on top of your head. Don't externalize yourself and don't set up Buddhas or anybody as great sages we're supposed to follow, whose rules and precepts and teachings we're supposed to honor. Buddha and Jesus come to life in us. They're real because we're real. And their real existence is our real existence. And when we live our lives truly, no matter what we call it, we are bringing them to life. Suzuki Roshi in this chapter seems to be saying, and I really feel this way myself, that all the world's religious and spiritual traditions come from one great human impulse. This impulse to be who we really are, in accord with reality, not fighting with it, and to express all of reality in our own lives. In this sense, he says, it doesn't matter what religion or non-religion we practice. Everyone is doing spiritual practice because every human being must be a spiritual being, no matter what they think or say, since we live and die, and we don't know why, and we all need some love and some meaning to survive. We all must be on a spiritual journey, and the more we pay attention to it, the better off we'll be. The great religions, each one formed by the culture in which it appears and in turn forming that culture, give us a way to find out who we really are, a way to fully enter the human life we are already inhabiting. Suzuki Roshi says in this chapter, when you really understand the great sages, you can no longer say, I am a Christian, I am a Buddhist. To really be a Christian or a Buddhist or anything in its truest sense is to accept the truth of all the ways of life as being expressive of our collective humanity. He writes, he says, I'm always happy when I see Christians come into the Zen Center or people from all kinds of religions. I'm happy when they come because the Zen Center isn't just for Soto Zen Buddhists, it's for everyone. And I feel like that too. I don't do it so much anymore, but decades ago I used to do lots of practice with all kinds of different Buddhist groups and Christian monastics and Jewish practice and some with Muslims, some ceremonies with indigenous people down in Mexico. And I really like doing that because when I do that, I understand more about myself and more about Soto Zen and more about being human. And isn't it kind of sad and unsettling that now in the world religion has become, again, as it was too often in the past, a source of great contention? Because people put a Christian or a Buddhist head on top of their head. And then they face each other with all their extra heads. And they start yelling at one another out of those extra mouths, insisting that they're right and the other guy's wrong. I don't think that's what religions are for. I think they're supposed to give us vision and comfort and hope and consolation, wisdom, and a path through life. Well, that's what I wanted to tell you today, and I recommend Suzuki Roshi's Becoming Yourself and Suzuki Roshi's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and also Not Always So. These are wonderful books. Suzuki Roshi was such a great teacher for us. His way of expressing the Dharma was crafted in our world, and so we're really grateful to him for it. So thanks for listening. I really appreciate it. So we always, maybe some of you are new to our little sitting community, but we always, at the end of the Dharma talk, we always discuss the talk in little groups and try to understand for ourselves what we heard. So we organize ourselves spontaneously into groups of three, moving our cushions or chairs around, so we're little clutches of three. And we always say, let's see if we can mix it up so that the people who know each other really well are looking for people that they don't know so well, so that we can get to know each other. So we'll find groups of three. And before you go, I'll tell you the question I had in mind for you to discuss, if you're willing. And you can imagine, it's what? How do you experience putting a head on top of your head, or not putting a head on top of your head? So this is something you can talk about in the light of sitting today, you know, specifically in the light of your Zazen practice, or you can talk about it in a bigger scope, in the light of your where you live your lives every day. So what's it like for you in your life and your understanding to put a head on top of your head or not to put a head on top of your head? Okay, so we're going to do that online. The folks online will get in groups of three, and you'll get in groups of three. I think just a word about this, most of you know this already, but the idea is that everybody's going to get 3 minutes to speak to this question, 3 uninterrupted minutes. Nobody's going to ask you a question or say anything. Just listen to you for 3 minutes. You can be silent if you want to be silent. You don't have to speak, but you'll still get your 3 minutes. And that's fine, because we know how to sit together in silence, right? We already figured that one out. So 3 minutes of uninterrupted time. And then after that, maybe 3 more minutes at the end for whatever else needs to be said. And John, will you time them?
Yeah,
John will time and ring a little bell at the end of 3 minutes. And then at the end, when we're done, we'll all come together and see what anybody has to say.